Disclaimer: this podcast has been prepared and is intended to provide and be used strictly for educational and informational purposes only. It is not intended to provide the listener with any type of tax, legal, business, accounting, financial, or investment advice. The consumer of the information presented should consult their own personal tax, accounting, financial, legal, business, and investment advisors. The host is not licensed and has never had a license to practice law, tax, finance, accounting, nor is he intending to offer any of those services or any type of business, financial, or investment advice. The host is licensed to engage in the practice of medicine. With that disclaimer out of the way, I'd now like to welcome you to Parasitic Capitalism, a podcast devoted to ending world hunger using real estate, intangibles, and the capitalist markets. This podcast is devoted to those people around the world who live in poverty and need hope for a better solution. It is a podcast where people who love capitalism can learn new ways to think about capitalism and how it, through the lens of parasitic capitalism, can be used to make this world a better place to live, work, and play. Although some people may think this new way of thinking and our discussions are purely theoretical in nature, what would happen if they became a reality? Many of our topics are ones that you're already familiar with, such as money, real estate, economics, taxes, poverty, and the capital and financial markets. However, some of the things that we'll be talking about will be things that you may have never heard of, or perhaps you've never realized or thought about, or looked at from this new and different perspective. So if you want to learn and be exposed to how we make topics which are familiar to you, unfamiliar, and strange, then this is the place to be and where it all comes together. Hello, everyone. My name is Dale Newton, and I will be your host for the next 30 to 45 minutes. And I have the unique pleasure of speaking with invited guests about several different topics and about a very interesting and exciting topic called parasitic capitalism, or PCAP for short. The purpose of this podcast is to present, hopefully, new information and material and to motivate dialogue and engaging discussions about parasitic capitalism and the world of intangibles. So what the heck is parasitic capitalism? Well, to answer that question, it may take just a little bit of time, so please be patient. Albert Einstein once said, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking that we used when we created them." So for now, let's just say that parasitic capitalism can be thought of as a Swiss Army knife. And with it, we believe that it can be used, for example, as a tool to help you discover new knowledge, improve your understanding, and to gain more insight about such things as capitalism and how it operates. Not to mention other economic systems that can be discussed and looked at from a similar perspective. Concepts such as real estate, intangibles, options, world poverty, and the capitalist markets are simply doorways to invite listeners into the conversation where they can reflect upon and share their own personal knowledge and experience and help to complete the big picture. But these concepts are just not the only ways to frame our discussions, because we will be talking about intellectual property, trademarks, patents, derivatives, options exchanges, consumer debt, and much more. My role is to serve as a curator and to facilitate the telling of a story, the story of capitalism, and what it could look like if viewed through the lens of parasitic capitalism. Without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce one of our first guests on our inaugural episode of the Parasitic Capitalism Podcast. I'm delighted to have you here today, Nathan. And I'd like to first tell the audience a few things about what has attracted me to this topic, parasitic capitalism, and why I thought you'd be an excellent guest to interview on our first inaugural podcast. And so to set the stage, I'll just share a couple things with you that got me interested in this area. I believe that there's a theological basis for capitalism, which in part is based on something called intangibles. And intangibles, we know, are things that cannot be seen
or touched or tasted, and yet they are all around us. And they are things which are connected to the tangible. Now, one of the things which is an intangible is called, for example, if you're spiritual-minded, faith or grace, mercy, love. But in the physical world, take, for example, real estate. There is something called intangible property. But these intangibles have value. And so parasitic capitalism, to me, is a type of intangible. It's a concept, but it's much more. And it depends upon the context that you're describing it. And to some extent, one might think of parasitic capitalism as a Swiss Army knife that is yet to be opened and explored and see what you can do with it. So my objective for the podcast is to try as best I can to explain the how and why we should think about capitalism, perhaps in a different context, both to rethink what we believe we know and understand, and also to unlearn some things and prepare ourselves to learn some new things. In preparation for this podcast, I mentioned two books to you. One book is written by Basil Al-Naqib, who is an independent scholar with a deep background in economics, investment banking, finance, and stock investing. And his book is entitled Two Centuries of Parasitic Economics: The Struggle for Economic and Political Democracy on the Eve of the Financial Collapse of the West, published in 2016. And he talks about parasitic economies, and he has a section about parasitic capitalism. The second book I mentioned is one written by Charles Adams, who is a tax attorney, who also is a history buff. And his book is called Good and Evil: The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And he traces the history of taxes through civilization. Your book, and you've written plenty of books, I'm quite aware of that. One of your latest books was called The Magic Formula. And you seem to talk about, and your work is focused on taxation and looking at taxes at various times during the history. So I'd like to tap into your experience and deep knowledge and try to find some type of connection between these ideas. And if you would, could you first begin by telling our listeners, what was it about economics that attracted you to the field?
That's a good question. I got started relatively late. I didn't study economics in college. And it arose when I was working in Japan in financial journalism, which I just kind of entered. I didn't have a lot of experience in financial journalism either. So this is, you know, I actually worked for Dow Jones, which publishes the Wall Street Journal, but for their newswire service. And so you had to kind of catch up on current events and topics of the day. And that was a time when economies were melting down everywhere in Asia, because that was the Asia crisis of 97, 98. And it soon became apparent to me that people who were in charge of things, this is the IMF and, you know, ministers of finance and central bank heads and large investors and Wall Street strategists and all these people who supposedly have responsibility for these matters or should at least have expertise in them, they were way over their heads. They didn't know what they were talking about. And even though I didn't know what I was talking about, I could tell they didn't know, right? It was even obvious to me. And of course, all these things were blowing up all over the place because basically these guys were incompetent, or because if they were competent, they wouldn't blow up. Makes sense, right?
Right.
It's like someone runs a car into the tree, says, "Oh, I'm a good driver." Maybe not. I don't need to know that much about cars and trees and driving to know that. Anyway, so I got started learning about things by that time. And it was very good that I was able, there's two interesting things about it. First, I was in an environment on the news desk with all the resources of the major organization and with a, you know, a job title that said I was supposed to know about this stuff. I could spend time at work doing it, which I thought was great. It actually paid me to, I wouldn't call it fooling around, but do what I love to do anyway. So in an environment where I had the resources and the time and excuse to study these things and also be able to do so independently without just studying for a test, you know, parroting what some professor guy says. Because I've seen since then that the academic process is just terribly crippling for, economists trained in that model. It's hard for them to ever overcome it. We can imagine anyway. So that was pretty interesting. And there are other, unfortunately, a lot of sort of self-trained independent economists also just kind of go off the deep end and get lost in silly stuff. But I was able to identify some people that I thought I could tell that you could just tell when someone has something they want to explain to you and it's important. Because they use a certain kind of language. It's kind of a simple language, right? Because they want to explain it to you. And so they use simple language. You know, if someone wants to act like the expert, they use very complicated language and you can't understand it, right? Whether it's you're talking with your doctor or you're talking with your tax attorney or whatever, it's like kind of the same principle, right? If they want you to know, they explain it really simply. So I can kind of just tell from the way they use words that someone, at least they thought they knew what was going on. And in fact, as I did, made sense of their ideas, I could tell that it was actually true. So that's kind of how that worked out. And I ended up starting to write my first book, which was more or less based on that experience, based on those couple, 2-3 years of looking into these topics, began in 2000, although it wasn't actually published until 2007. And of course, by 2007, I'd learned a lot more and got involved in economics professionally and so on and so forth. So that is kind of how I came about it. And to try to summarize it real simply is that, it's a lot of economics is not very well understood. And another big advantage I've had is I've been always involved in Wall Street, although often not very kind of on the fringes. And that has, Wall Street investing, it's all about the real world, right? and all of investing is about being wrong and then correcting your error, right? To some degree. Which is kind of the opposite of academics who never want to admit they're wrong and end up consequently making no progress because they never change, they never grow, they never develop, right? So that's, and I've seen that elsewhere. A lot of the best economists that I know are Wall Street related guys, but the problem is they never write books because they're so busy making money, doing other things besides writing books. So I kind of fit into this niche where I write books, but I also kind of have that Wall Street background. What I've kind of discovered through this whole process is there are a lot of things that are important, but are really not very well understood. And so we want to hopefully remedy that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Do you consider yourself a macroeconomist or more microeconomist? Is that a first?
That's a good question. Yeah, there are a lot of economists who just kind of have a specialty. There are this economics of health insurance, the economics of the Costa Rica tourist industry, or this kind of thing. And they usually do, pretty good work in that little sphere, and nothing you can really criticize them for. The big picture is kind of what the study of economics is known for. And this basically translates into national economic policy, macroeconomics. And then there's this break, which appeared in the 20th century with microeconomics and macroeconomics and microeconomics. They don't get along very well together. They're kind of oil and water because they're based on two different things. One's basically based on government manipulation. And the other one's based on free enterprise. Mm-hmm. Basically. And one of the things that the modern classical group, which I belong to, wants to do is eliminate that split, right? You can't to have national policy that makes sense from a micro standpoint. And then it'll all make sense, right? the macro policy is, well, we want to manipulate everybody. We want to, you know, pull the wool over everyone's eyes. Mm-hmm. And all the micro guys say, I want to understand what's going on so I can make money. And they're kind of, you know, in conflict. And so the macro policy is, we want to help you guys make money. And the micro guys say, right on, let's do it. And then everyone gets wealthy. That little, you know, simplifying what I think direction that things should go.
Well, a lot of your work seems to focus on, say, monetary policy or gold or currency, right. At least the work that I've taken a look at. And mm-hmm. I think of that in terms of, say, macroeconomics or national policies. Question is, what attracted you to that area in particular, dealing with money and currency and gold?
Basically, there are, you could think of national economic policy kind of in three spheres. One is regulation. You know, there's, you know, tens of thousands of pages of regulation for every industry. And for the most part, the regulatory stuff is kind of well understood. If there's some kind of regulation on the stepladder industry, mm-hmm. all the stepladder manufacturers kind of got to figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. there is a regulatory problem in the United States. There's just way too much regulation, way too much regulatory burden, and all the there's a, but that's in a sense it's kind of well understood. And then there's tax policy, which is not well understood, but which got some attention in, especially in sort of the Reagan era, the 1980s, the Reagan Thatcher stuff. And then in the 1990s, we had, you know, the flat tax proposals and fair tax proposals. There was some interesting thinking going on there, and people have heard about it. It's been publicly discussed pretty well, although not as well, I think, as it should be. And then the third section is the monetary stuff. And this is, for some people, the most difficult, because they kind of understand taxes, right? They kind of pay their taxes and they sort of get it. Oh, the government's taking my money. They sort of get it. But they wake up every morning and their $20 bill looks kind of like the same, but something's going on because they keep talking about it, you know, on TV or whatever, right? It's not quite sure what's happening. Anyway, that was really the focus of that Asia crisis, is basically monetary in character. And so I could tell there was a serious lack of understanding there, because all these people running around with their hair on fire and mm-hmm. obviously didn't know what they're doing at the time in 97, 98. And then it's an aspect of monetary of economic policy, which did not really get the explication sort of during the 70s and 80s and 90s that the tax stuff did. So I kind of follow the supply side tradition, if you want to call it that. And supply siders are kind of famous for advocating for lower taxes, you know, or laughers. Oh, yes, you know, lower taxes, which is good, which is true. But they're not as well known for their monetary stuff. And it needed, you know, I need books, mm-hmm. not just sound bites. You can have a sound bite, but it has to point to a book, right? Otherwise, it's just, what is that supposed to mean, right? We need sound money. Okay. I can tell you're excited about it, but what does that mean? Whatever it happens to be, right? And also some of the stuff that did exist on that stuff was just wrong. It's just stupid. Murray Rothbard, I'm talking to you about you. And so it had to be fixed. And so that's been a focus of mine. So my most recent book, now 2019, I call it The Magic Formula. And I intended it to be sort of an introductory book of the supply side view. So if you take government economic policy and you divide it into three spheres, regulatory, tax, and monetary, like I said, the regulatory stuff, usually people can kind of make sense of it themselves. Then you got to get the tax stuff right. And then you got to get the monetary stuff right. And usually if you get that stuff right, the effects are so good that you know, the results are going to be, the results are, two things could happen. The results are going to be pretty good.
Okay.
Even if you don't do anything for all of your stuff, right? Okay. And then because the results of that are pretty good, you sort of have like a foundation to build upon. And then you can do things like, I don't know, improve your educational system or, mm-hmm. you know, improve the laws regarding venture capital, or, you know, kind of like these little things that are important to kind of build up over time. Some of the legal structures and so forth. So that was kind of the message of that book, because it's real simple, but even today, governments get it wrong all the time. The United States is getting it wrong right now. And so there's consequences for that.
With that particular book, there's discussion about fiat currencies. Mm-hmm. And would you explain the difference between, say, fiat currency and in this modern age, you hear about digital currency, the blockchain and Bitcoin. Are they right. the same? Are they different?
Well, they are different because the typical cryptocurrency is basically a fixed supply system. It is basically the, it's not quite the NFT version of things. You know, people have compared it to limited edition art prints, like Andy Warhol made 175 images of Marilyn Monroe in a run. It's limited supply. It's 175 pictures. And then it has a market value depending on whether people place value on this picture of Marilyn Monroe. So that's a little different than a fiat currency. The basic idea of a fiat currency is that the supply of it is determined by a government, you know, an authority, a central bank. And in practice, what it means is they just kind of make it up as they go along. It's kind of the seat of the pants thing, right? They always talk about a gazillion things, right? Oh, well, employment did this and the price of oil did that. And, you know, the bond market did this other thing and blah, 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 blah. And you know, they kind of act like these super smart guys. But the end result is they, one way or the other, do things with the currency, and it has no fixed value. It has no fixed definition. It has no fixed, you know, plan. You know, at least Bitcoin says, well, there's X many Bitcoins in the world, right? Okay. Well, what's the rule for the dollar?
Okay.
There is none. They just make stuff up as they go along, right? And we just cross our fingers and hope they don't make a mess. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of fiat. So fiat means basically a government command, right? Mm-hmm. So that's basically the nature of it. And then typically in the history of money, history of currencies, the other major option, you know, there really has never been a fixed supply currency.
Okay.
Like Bitcoin. Bitcoin's not really a currency. You know, there's been things that have fixed supplies like Andy Warhol prints or, you know, first edition Superman comic books or, you know, Mickey Mantle baseball cards all mm-hmm. have fixed supplies, all tradable, all collectible, all valued by people. But that never really functions as a monetary system. But the other major system, which has been by far the most common system over 5,000 years of human civilization, is some kind of fixed value. Okay. So today, this very common, you know, most of the countries in the world actually fix the value of their currencies to typically a major international currency, mostly the US dollar or the euro. Some are linked to the Australian dollar, some are linked to the Canadian dollar, some have currency baskets, some are linked to the South African rand. So there are other options, but mostly it's dollars and euros. So you know, in for dollar-based currencies, for example, most of the Caribbean currencies, all these little countries in the Caribbean, they all have dollar-based currencies. They don't have their own floating fiat, la-di-da. Mm-hmm. Historically, Asia was dollar-linked, and that kind of changed in the Asia crisis. That's what blew up. China used to be dollar linked, and now it's kind of loosely dollar linked. So most of the countries in the world actually have a fixed value policy. They say, even though they sometimes don't implement it very well, they say, you know, our local la-di-da is worth X dollars. That's the policy, right? And then, so in the past, all the countries, well, not all the countries, but the major countries also did the same thing, but they didn't link their currencies to some other fiat currency, they linked it to gold, or a major currency that was itself linked to gold. So So that was the, we're kind of going backwards in history rather than forwards. But so that was the system up until 1971. Most people don't realize that that is the way the world was run until, for centuries up until 1971. Currencies were based on gold. And the result was that they had a value that was obviously as stable as gold. And in practice, that was pretty stable and stable enough, and things worked out okay. And you could think of it as the idea was kind of like the dollar or any currency that is linked to gold was kind of like a fixed measuring rod. It's like a foot, right? Or a meter or whatever, whatever your fixed value is. And you could say it's, even if it wasn't quite, gold is maybe not quite perfectly unchanging in value. Mm-hmm. It's pretty close. You could think of it maybe like a cucumber, which they're not all the same length, but they're all pretty similar, right? Anyway, it's a natural measure of length, right? One cucumber, one foot, right. Like literally a human foot, right? Is a natural measure of length that doesn't change very much. It can change by 10 or 20%, but it's not going to collapse to 1% of its prior length or value as our currencies do today. So then if you go back, farther, you get gold coins and silver coins. And the whole idea of a gold coin or silver coin was that it would contain an unchanging amount of gold. And governments often violated that principle, but nevertheless, that was the idea. And there are gold coins that governments maintained unchanging for over 700 years. Pretty long time. So anyway, that's kind of very brief history of these things. So, so it's very important to understand there's really only been, I kind of dismissed Bitcoin, the fixed supply model. There's really only been two models over the last 200 years. And that is the fixed value system, which is very popular today, the fixed to the dollar. In the past, before 1971, not that long ago, fixed to gold. The fixed value model, or what I call the PhD standard, which is a bunch of smart guys sit in a room and they just make stuff up, which is what we have today, right? They just they sit around and make stuff up. And no matter how well-intentioned they are, no matter how smart they are, there's always, those guys just weren't smart enough. We just need someone smarter. Well, when has that ever happened? Right? Show me one example of success, some guy who was smart enough. Anyway, and from day to day and from week to week and from year to year, they kind of, they argue and blah, 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 and they talk and all this stuff. But there's a clear long-term trend. And the clear long-term trend is that over decades, currencies lose value. So our dollar today, by my estimate, is only worth about 1/50th of what it was worth in the 1960s. And if you just look at any country, look at any country today whose currency drops by a factor of, worth 1/50th of what it used to be worth, whether it's Mexico or Chile or, I don't know, Egypt or Bangladesh or whenever you see a country whose currency does that, the results are never good.
Okay.
Right. Without going into a lot of economic detail, we just kind of know that when the Bangladesh, I don't even know what their currency is, Banier goes from 100 to the dollar to 5,000 to the dollar, 51 decline. It's going to suck to be Bangladeshi, right? We all kind of have a basic idea, basic concept of that. But that's kind of what happened to us over the last 50 years. And that's why, we have all these amazing technological improvements. But millennials today, they say, you know what? It seems like my grandparents were better able to get by at age 28 or at age 32 than me, right? They bought a house, they got married, their wife stayed home, took care of the kids, they had a car, they didn't have student debt. They had a 10, 15% savings rate. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that working? 60 years later, all the economists say we're twice as rich. They had these literally statistics. We're supposed to be twice as rich as those guys, but I can't afford any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. What's up? Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, buddy. Your value currency is only 1/50th of what it used to be. That's what happens. So kind of a long story, but I think that's a very important point that's going to be, core element in listeners' lives, and they should understand what's going on.
And when you say 1/50th of the value. That means they're able to buy only half as much purchasing power, if you will, than years before. Is that correct?
No, more like, you know, 1/20th or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Because things have actually gotten cheaper. So the purchasing, the so-called purchasing power is not quite 50 to 1. But, you know, statistics are very difficult because it's hard to compare since things are so far apart. But nevertheless, you know, you look and without bickering over statistics, oh, it's not really 51, it's 30 to 1. You know, who cares? Right. Nevertheless, I think there is a sense in America that for some reason, technology is much better, but we're not obviously better off.
Okay.
After 60 years, 50 years, 50 years since 1971. Unless things change for the better, I don't think the next 50 years are going to be much change. We'll have fantastic technology and we're still going to feel like we're not very, very well off. Anyway, there you go.
You mentioned millennials, and I think that's a good point because they are attracted to technology. And I believe they're attracted perhaps to Bitcoins and blockchain and the latest apps. So there are two legal cases I'm aware of that have either already been settled or they're still pending that deal with those two topics, the digital currency. Mm-hmm. One of those legal cases currently pending is the Security Exchange Commission is suing a company called Ripple. Mm-hmm. Ripple has developed a virtual currency or digital asset. And as of today's date, March 4th, the SEC seems to take the position that that digital currency should be treated as a security. There's a much earlier, much older case that dealt with the Commodities Future Trade Commission. In that case, they were dealing with a digital asset, and the commissioner argued that it should be treated as a commodity. So between these two major organizations or agencies, my question is whether a digital currency, Bitcoin or whatever, is, in your opinion, should be treated as a and viewed as a security or as an option. Any feeling for that?
It depends on the nature of the thing. There was a problem with what amounts to securitization on blockchain that was, you know, kind of breaking out, I don't know, 2018 or so. And the SEC clamped down on it and they basically were correct to do so. Okay. So this is, you know, the basic idea of a security is that it indicates it's a contract that indicates some kind of claim on some asset. You know, it's not just a digital, asset. And because Ripple or whatever can be used in that way, it might be, I don't know the exact details, but it might be used that way. And as a security, there's a giant amount of securities law related to that. As a commodity, I mean, I'm not quite sure I would necessarily call it a commodity. But in general, just to interject another good principle, one of the things we'd like to see part of this has to do with taxation. How do you tax them, right? And in general, I think that transactions and assets, whether it be stocks or bonds or currencies or gold or commodities or art or whatever, houses, transaction assets should not be taxed. And of course they weren't in the past for a variety of reasons. And that would hopefully simplify the regulatory environment for not only Ripple, but all kinds of alternative money-like units. There's already a big push to do this. There's already, I think 40 states have already taken steps to put gold and silver into a basically remove taxes on them, basically declare that as monetary items, they are free of taxes, and then you can trade them back and forth without having Kevin keep records and pay taxes, right? Mm-hmm. So I hope that principle extends to other potentially monetary instruments.
So taxes
or assets. It'd be nice if it transferred assets as a whole, but let's start there.
Taxes typically are levied against tangible things, but are not levied against intangible things. Is that correct?
Well, no. Currencies, just euros. If you're a currency trader, it's pretty intangible. Not banknotes, but trading on screen. Okay. Or equities. They don't really exist. They're just digital entries, bonds. They're all pretty intangible. But just as a general principle, I think that all assets should not be, transactions in them should not be taxed. What you should be taxing is instead economic activity, basically businesses, right? So you have a corporate tax, but not a tax on stock trading.
Okay. So perhaps tax the income derived from owning that intangible is the way to go. Is that?
Basically, it kind of gets into some tax principles, mm-hmm. Which are good and which is good in a sense. And basically, people have worked out the last 20 years. What is an ideal tax system, right? That kind mm-hmm. of, well, what they figured out is that we basically want to tax everyone at the same rate,
right?
Rich guys don't get a very high tax and they don't get a very low tax. You have everything at the same rate and you don't have double taxes and, layers of taxes and all this stuff. You just kind of like everyone just faces that one hurdle and they pay their dues and they're done. Mm-hmm. So basically what that is VAT. People don't really understand what a VAT is, but if you could have an ideal federal tax system, it basically will be a single rate VAT, and you could, which would, people think of VAT as sort of like a sales tax, but it's actually a little more complicated. That's actually resembles an income tax. So in essence, a VAT taxes corporate and employee income at the same rate.
A VAT is a value added tax, correct?
Right. Okay. I could, if you want to talk about that. It's an interesting topic, actually. Anyway.
Well, going back to one of your books, I think the magic formula, you say that countries with low or falling taxes and stable money tend to thrive and prosper. Mm-hmm. And countries with high or rising taxes and unstable money tend to stagnate and decline. Mm-hmm. And it is a necessary and even a sufficient condition for economic success. And my question to you is it possible for a country to have no taxes, mm-hmm. the VAT or an income tax or a sales tax, and still be an economic success?
We can kind of imagine, literally no taxes. Mm-hmm. How could you get away with that? You have to, it's hard to imagine what you could use for, government needs some kind of revenue, mm-hmm. but you could get by with not much. The United States federal government, for most of the 19th century had revenue of like 3% of GDP. It was really low. So you can get by with not very much, 3% kind of low. I quoted a Chinese philosopher from the 5th century. He said, 10% is the number you want. Mm-hmm. 10% is enough to pay for government services, including military defense. Yeah. Right? If you don't have a military, your country's not going to be long very well for very long, because some other guy is going to figure out he's going to come by and take your stuff. Mm-hmm. But then when you get over 10%, then things become impressive. And so he said, that's the number. Okay. And I have to say, today I tend to agree. At least if you leave out the welfare stuff, if you eliminated the welfare stuff, just the other functions of the government. Yeah, 10% is about right. But in the past, United States of 5% was really running close to the line, right? Really, really bare bones operation. And so, you know, how would you figure that? And probably would have to amount to one of two things, or two, basically two things. One is profits from the money system itself.
Okay.
Called seigniorage. You know, the issuance of the currency, which is a type of business. If you look at it as a type of business, just like commercial enterprise, you could think of it that way. And you can get, I'm not sure what, but you know, a couple percent of GDP that way, maybe. And another one would simply be, basically ownership of some other kind of business. And in the past, governments have had salt monopolies. You know, they basically mine salt and they sell it for regulated price and things like that, which governments have gotten out of because they're such bad, but governments are terrible businessmen. And you just can't generate that much revenue from profits from a salt mine to run a government. So unfortunately, taxes is probably with us for a while. So it's good to you're talking about predatory capitalism. Taxes is one of the age old means of tyranny and oppression, which basically means predation via taxes, mm-hmm. or something like that. And there was a really interesting book recently called The Maker and the Takers by Jerry Boyer, who's kind of a conservative Christian economics commentator, where he looked at, the parables of Jesus and his public pronouncements during, as recorded in the Gospels, as basically being admonitions to the government of the time, the Herodites, to stop taxing the heck out of the Judeans.
Right.
Because they're, it's great. You just, call it taxes, call it government, but you take their money and you enjoy a very comfortable lifestyle. And that's what they were doing. It's been around a long time. Predation, if you will, via taxation.
That's an interesting book. I'll have to take a look at that book. What concerns me is whether governments have come up with another solution to help support themselves, mm-hmm. and to help maintain their existence. Other than taxes and tariffs, is there any other type of substitute good or something that exists that governments can use as a replacement?
No, not really. Of course, then you get into money. The governments have printed money, or right. varieties of, variants on that theme for literally thousands of years. Okay. And even before they had paper money, they would debase the coin. So basically, debasing has two potential aspects. One is you take a coin that's 100% silver and you put some copper in it, so it's only 50% silver. Mm-hmm. And you can literally, take a coin and tax revenue, remint it into two coins, double your money. It's not quite printing, but it's a very similar process. The other thing they would do is they would take a coin and it had a face value, one shekel or whatever. And they just take a hammer and go bam, and they put a print 10 shekels on it. They just turned a one shekel coin to a 10 shekel coin. this would actually happen. And so that's another way of, essentially, in essence, printing money. And people have been doing this since, fifth century BC. So that has been around a long time too. And that is undoubtedly part of our current situation. We all know central banks have been printing a ton of money.
Right.
They've been buying government bonds with it. And there's a benign aspect to that, but it's starting to smell pretty funny. And I think that we are in substantial risk of it getting out of hand in the next 10 years.
I think we're up to $8 trillion of asset on the balance sheets or someplace.
Almost nine at the Fed. I think it might have crossed nine by now. It's actually about $6 trillion in what we would call money, which is still a heck of a lot. Yeah. if you literally think about it, just printing money, if you go home and print money on your laser printer and they that's kind of essentially what they did, and they made 6 trillion of them. Now they, you know, they have to make, we need something. We need, we have a natural need for transactional medium. So that's good. But it can easily get out of hand. And they were sort of at the brink of that now, I would say.
Your book, The Magic Formula, you had a graph. The title was called Government Debt as a Ratio of GDP. Mm-hmm. And it looked at advanced economies from, say, 1880 to 2017. Mm-hmm. And I found a paragraph that you quoted, and I'd like to read that for you.
Sure.
It says, a wide variety of post-war era institutions and forms of organizations have become rotten, problematic, or even played out and exhausted, including the university system and public education as a whole, the pattern of automobile dependent suburbia, and overly complicated and parasitic financial system. The Central Intelligence Agency, International Monetary Fund, NATO, and the United Nations, a military-industrial complex that includes roughly 1,000 military bases on foreign soil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful statement. A lot of stuff packed in there. One of the things that caught my attention was your use and description of what you called parasitic financial system. Could you tell our listeners what you mean by that and where and how that fits into your thinking?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know what a financial system is. They turn on CNBC and stocks go up and down. There's always people talking heads, blah, blah, blah. But what is a financial system? We know what an electrical system is. Mm-hmm. We know what a cable, you know, internet system is. We know what, well, what's a financial system? What does it do? What's it for?
Right.
Why do all these people get paid for working there? Well, what it's supposed to do, financial system provides finance.
Okay.
When you have an idea, I want to buy a house, don't have quite enough money. Mm-hmm. You go to the financial system, say, can you finance my house? And they say, yeah, we'll loan you some money. Where did that money come from? Well, it came from someone who saved some money. And so you were financed by the financial system. You buy your house. And if you own a business, if you're, you know, Tesla, and maybe not Tesla, but maybe Tesla, they say, well, they go to the bank and say, you know, we want to build a gigafactory for make batteries. So how much money do you need? Well, we need about $500 million. They're okay. And they work out a deal. And then on the other side of the financial system are the savers, right?
Okay.
They say, well, instead of spending this money, I want to earn interest, or I want to buy equities. I want to invest in a company, and, you know, equity investment or venture capital, or, you know, they want to invest somehow. So they give their money, right? In venture capital. So that's a buying a house or building a factory with debt. And then venture capital, you know, the guy says, well, I have this great idea. I'm going to make, you know, Twitter or whatever. Mm-hmm. I need 10 million to get going. It's like, all right, another one of these nut jobs, but sometimes it works out. And then on the other hand, you got, you know, the Harvard Endowment. They say, you know, let's invest 10 million in that VC fund and maybe you'll have the next big thing. And that's the financial system. The money goes from the Harvard Endowment to that guy with a big idea, and maybe it works out. And maybe everyone makes lots of money. That's what the financial system does. And the financial system in the 1960s, before the era of floating fiat currencies, it was real primitive. It's hard to imagine today, but in those days, in 1960, John F. Kennedy was president. Mm-hmm. If you went to a bank, you went to a Wall Street broker, stockbroker, they had a rotary phone. Mm-hmm. They had a vacuum tube television and radio. They might've had a ticker and they kept records with a pencil in a book. And if you bought a share, you actually received a paper share certificate. Mm-hmm. They would mail it to you with the US Postal Service, et cetera, et cetera. If you went to a bank, they actually had a person there known as the teller. Had not yet been automated. And they say, can I get some money? And she would say, okay, sure. Because mm-hmm. they still have tellers, but you know, they didn't have ATMs. They didn't have, you know, credit cards were still marginally used. Debit cards and all this card stuff, right? Marginally used. So the point is real, it was real primitive, right? All that stuff's now automated. Well, if it's all automated now, it should require much fewer people and cost much less money. Shouldn't it?
Right.
It worked then, right? American people save money. People invest in the stock market. People invest in mutual funds. American business got the money it needed to build factories and hire people. And the United States was, super successful and everything's fine. And now after, 50 years of electronics and all this stuff, which would seem to eliminate, 80% of the jobs. In those days, the financial system was about 6% of GDP to pay all the people and all the buildings to provide that service. Cost about 6% of GDP. And today the financial system is 12% of GDP.
Wow.
So what happened?
Yeah.
And basically what happened is, it should be 3% of GDP, right? It should have gone down, right? It should be like just automated, right? So what happened? And somehow the financial system is, it's kind of like a parasite sucking 9% of GDP out of the economy one way or the other. And, paying all the high price people who provide those services. Cause it doesn't, all it does is connect capital. All it does is connect investors and savers, right?
Right.
It just finances. It doesn't produce any end goods or services. It doesn't produce any intermediate, it doesn't build factories. It doesn't produce capital goods. Mm-hmm. It doesn't provide anything. They just fuss with numbers. So that's a parasitic element. And if you go back hundreds of years, the very first book that was written about monetary topics in the history of the West, going back to Aristotle, first guy was in the 14th century. And I mentioned this in my book. He was advisor to the King of France. And he said, told the King, just leave the coins the way they are.
Okay.
I know you can help pay your bills if you reduce the silver and all the stuff I was explaining, but it just screws everything up. So just leave the coins the way they are. And it'll be better. And he said, when you start to play with money, what happens is you get all these opportunists and wise guys and speculators who understand what's going on, are able to take advantage of the situation, and they get rich. And all the people who are just kind of going along, they're doing work and they're saving in the bank, they're going to get screwed. Mm-hmm. The productive elements of society do worse, and you feed this parasite class of people who are somehow benefiting from the change to the coinage. This is the 14th century.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happened today. We have funny money. We have this floating fiat currency, and we've got this huge parasite class of financial wise guys that has grown up around it, essentially. Nothing's changed.
That's the expression, the parasitic financial system. It's trying to address where and how. And I like your example. It used to be, say, 6% GDP, the financial sector, and it costs as much as 9% for the same services, connecting savers and investors.
Yeah. So we're up about 12% now, I think. So I'm estimating it's about 9% of just, blood sucking. It should be, if it was 6% in the 1960s, it should go to 3 because of all the computers and stuff. So I'm just guessing there's 9% of straight up blood sucking there, which is a lot. It's a lot. You ever see that, that part on your paycheck where they take out the federal payroll tax?
Sure.
That's 7%. So just imagine 9% is.
Got it.
Right.
good example. We've got a few more minutes, so let me know if we need to look at a part two. I'm more than happy to continue this conversation.
Sure.
In terms of the book that I referenced earlier by Basil, Two Centuries of Parasitic Economics, one of his topics or items that he mentions is called parasitic capitalism. And he tries to describe this as something that's important for the general public to know about and be aware of. I don't know how much his book has been picked up or written about or talked about. So I found it interesting, and that's why I kind of took a deep dive into it. He states on page 25 that the book is a dialogue, not just with students of economics, but also with students of public finance, banking, investment, political science, and sociology. Most of all, I wanted the general public to see the possibility that good economics, stripped of the fog of political ideologies, can dramatically improve the lives of people. The public needs to become an interested party because it has endured the worst consequences of parasitic economics that has precipitated debt crises, unfair taxation, and misdirected public expenditure. I take what you've said, and I take what Basil has said, referring to parasitic economics, and your comment that you just made about the 9%, and I say, wow, where have we been? Why has no one been talking about this? What's going on here? And of course, we hear about other countries and the hyperinflation and other countries and their dollar getting devalued and a lot of, I guess, distraction, if you will. But if we look at our own system and what we perhaps should focus more attention to, I think there's something to be said for this topic and trying to get our heads around it and understand what the average person needs to know and take home from. And with that being said, I'd love to continue this conversation at another time, if that will fit your schedule. Would you be willing to come back and be another guest on the podcast?
Sure. Sounds like fun.
Thank you so much for your time. And Nathan, have a great afternoon.
Sure. Thank you.